Supervisors to order this morning, and Sarah, do you pledge for us, please?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning.
Morning. Spring together. Heavenly Father, we come together again for another meeting of the Board of Supervisors for our county. Thank you again for their work and their efforts and their leadership and all that takes place within our county. We thank you for our workers and those who support everything that is taking place in our county. I want to think especially of our first responders and fire. As we know, it's that time of year and many fires in north of us. Father, I pray for their protection, pray for their leadership and all that they do and participate. We give you thanks as a community for those who protect us. As we come to the end of our summer, we pray for those last moment vacations and time away. May it be good time for families as school is about to begin. Thank you for our children. May we be good examples for them in life. And in all of our busyness, help us to enjoy each moment of every day. We thank you for your blessings. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Wendy.
All righty, roll call. Supervisor Valenzuela.
Here.
Supervisor Ogren.
Present.
Supervisor Harris.
Present.
Supervisor Haupt.
Present.
And do we know if Cobb Seth will be in at all?
He said he'll be late.
We'll be late. Okay, thank you.
Okay, presentations from the public. Item 4, time slot is for information from the public. No action or discussion will be conducted on matters presented at this time. You'll be allowed 3 minutes for your presentation. Written comments can be presented if so, but excuse me. I'm dead this morning. Written comments can be presented if so desired. Please provide a minimum of 7 copies to the clerk. And when addressing the board, please state your name for the record prior to providing your comments. And please address the board as a whole through the chair. Comments should be limited to matters within the jurisdiction of the board. I don't have any blue cards. Is there any in-house?
Nothing here.
Is there anything
showing them online?
All right. That then I'll go to consent agenda.
G.
Yeah, we're going to pull G for discussion. Any others?
Item 5G.
Yeah.
And that was Supervisor Ogren.
Yep.
Yeah.
No others?
No others. I move to approve the balance.
Second.
All right, Supervisor Valenzuela.
Yep.
Supervisor Ogren.
Aye.
Supervisor Harris.
Aye.
And Supervisor Howe.
Aye. Item G. I don't see anybody. That's too bad.
Well, that's too
bad. Oh, I've come back.
I may be able to help.
Oh, sure you
can. Maybe.
Oh, I don't think you want to hear what I have to say.
No.
I would be happy to hear what you have to say. And I know our county administrator has information on this too. I don't know if you want to ask either one of us your questions or if you want us to pass.
Well, maybe I'll start. Just a couple things about this. This contract. This for approval that would have expired in May. So not very timely. And see, we do have sheriff's rep here.
You should probably come up.
Come on up.
Don't sit down.
Yeah. We're discussing G. Good morning.
Good morning. Courtney Greenlee, Administrative Services Manager for the Sheriff's Office.
So Courtney, I was just making some comment about how late this is coming in. With it, the end of this was in May. backing this up, post-dating it. I'm getting a little tired of these, so you know, because what it says to me is we're just not doing the job right. We're doing it in a timely manner. That's not good public policy. I am a little remiss in that there isn't some kind of payment schedule in this to let me know what services we provide and for how much. I know we do have a payment that was made, but I don't see where we billed that, you know, or for how much.
A payment has not been made by the city of Oklahoma yet, and this was drafted as a rate contract for actuals, depending on who was assigned to the services. This was an unanticipated request for additional services from the city of Wairika through the Wairika Police Department. They found themselves in a scenario with high turnover and two positions dependent on the graduation of two cadets of the academy. And sometimes mandatory overtime is not enough to provide the adequate services to the city. So the fiscal office was notified the day services began, which was considered an urgent between the sheriff and the chief of police. This was basically the soonest we could get it here. It was going to be an open-ended term, but by the time we were ready to get signatures, we had discovered that services had ended, which is in alignment with most spring academies that come to closure. So our understanding was that two of those positions were filled in June, and that's most likely why they didn't need additional services. But like I said, this was not an anticipated need.
I guess the question I have, and it's probably more one from council, is that we're operating without authorization because we don't have a contract in place. Is our liability covered under the mutual aid request, or are we just kind of hanging out there?
We should be. However, my office will take a look and work with the sheriff's office to see if we can build into place a system where we can have these things in place in the event that there are needs in the future. But off the top of my head, I believe our liability is already covered. In addition to that, the fact that we also simply say the answer to that question is more likely than not yes, but I'll look into it. And then I'll also look into working with the sheriff's office and the different cities to put systems in place so that we don't have this occur again.
Well, that's my question again on the liability standpoint. It's not like this shortage snuck up on them, like an ongoing incident or something like that where we respond. I mean, this was staffing that was asked for and staffed, I guess, on a kind of a periodic basis.
Right.
That's my concern with the liability piece.
We'll put systems in, my office will work with the sheriff's office to put systems in place so that in the event this happens again with any of the other cities that we can already have the contracts in place.
Okay. My perspective, I don't want to see these anymore.
I don't want to receive requests late anymore. but like I said, the John and the city council that we worked with prior to circulating for county and purple were very responsive and easy to work with, and I appreciate that.
Question?
Well, quick comment. You know, I get things, scenarios play out, but this seems like a recurring theme with the sheriff's department. We do something after the fact. You could have at least came before and gave us a heads up, this is coming down the pike, and said, all of a sudden we're having this discussion now after the fact type thing. And I feel like I'm getting blindsided is what it comes down to.
I can make note of that for the future. This was a decision made by the sheriff and Chief Gilman that I'm just facilitating.
I understand your role in the position, but still.
They've said everything that I've been saying for the last 4 or 5 years. We brought this same scenario over and over and over again with work being done either with delayed contracts or no contract, and then trying to fill in the gaps. And this is just another event with the same outcome, that we are approving things that are with the work already completed. It really has to stop. We understand the situation, but we need to know about it ahead of time. Just like Supervisor Valenzuela said, at least to give us a heads up that it's coming, that the situation is, you know, in front of us. Where's the contract for the other cities? We're still, are we still negotiating that? Are we still
with the cities for signature?
I mean, we've asked over and over again for updates on that. We still don't. Thank you.
I didn't know updates were being requested.
You know, we've talked about that over and over and over again. Same thing. We're still working without contracts. I appreciate the council is looking into that. We've asked for that information over and over again as well. We cannot keep operating this way. We're in budget deficit. We're running on empty. We're trying to figure out how to manage our own budgets, and this is part of it. We cannot keep working without revenue. It doesn't, every department is in the same situation. This department is no different. So we're begging for your help at this point.
I'll make sure leadership understands.
Thank you so much.
Move to approve.
I'll second.
Supervisor Valenzuela?
Okay.
Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
And Supervisor Hell?
Reluctantly, aye.
Thank you.
Okay. Pacific Power. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning. Somebody said they were
working on that, right?
Okay, yeah. Got it. All right. Well, then I will start just by introductions. First of all, thank you, Chair Haupt and supervisors, for having us here today. My name is Jill Drinkwater. I'm the regional business manager for California for Pacific Power. So I serve the counties of Del Norte, Siskiyou, Modoc, and a little bit of Shasta County. I mainly work with our jurisdictions, our communities, our larger business customers, help facilitate major load additions, and just in general act as a communication liaison from our communities and our customers to the company and from the company to back to our communities. So we're here to share some information today. I would like to have my colleagues introduce themselves, and then we'll walk through this presentation.
Good morning, and thank you for having us. So I'm Alan Meyer. I'm the Director of Customer Community Affairs for Pacific Power South, so Southern Oregon and Northern California.
Good morning. My name is Dave Schober. I'm the Principal Project Manager for all the wildfire mitigation projects happening for this area. Thanks.
So we're here today just to share some information on the system hardening efforts and projects that we have been conducting throughout our California service territory. For almost 6 years now. One of the things that we really want to stress is that our number one goal as a company is the safety of our customers and the safety of our communities. We are always here to provide safe and reliable power. We are challenged currently, as you know, with extreme weather, wildfire, and so making sure that our system is safe has required an incredible investment from the company to harden this system so that we can be more resilient and more resistant to the risk of wildfire in our communities. These investments in customer safety and system strength, they come at significant costs, and unfortunately these costs are borne by our ratepayers. So the map here on this first slide just kind of gives an idea of how large our California service territory is. We're looking at roughly over 11,000 square miles. Across that 11,000 square miles, we have a very sparse number of customers, only 46,000 customers. So we're looking at 4 customers per square mile. And as you guys know, this territory across the region is very geographically diverse, and for the most part, it's very geographically challenging. We are heavily forested with a lot of very remote areas, difficult and challenging to get to. You can go to the next slide.
I got a quick question. 46,000 customers, is that a steady number throughout the past few years?
I've been here for 3 years, and so in my 3 years, that has remained constant, yes.
Okay.
Yep. So across our service territory, we have implemented some modeling tools to determine where the fire risk is greatest. And so you can see those identified in the green and the orange. The green and the orange is what California has determined to be our Tier 2 high and Tier 2 high fire threat districts. The purple is what we as Pacific Power have used our modeling tools to determine that they are high fire risk areas. The point of this slide is to show you that over 60% of our California service territory falls into this high fire risk area. So roughly half of our customers are residing in these high risk areas. You can go to the next slide. So the key activities, prioritizing by risk. So from that map that you just saw, prioritizing by risk, we've been making the investments to harden our system. We have been replacing bare wire with covered conductor. The covered conductor has a couple benefits, key benefits. It reduces the risk of ignition during wildfire season. It's covered so it doesn't spark if it hits the ground. It also really helps us in the wintertime by improving reliability. Because it's not as sensitive to a tree falling on the line, or tree or a branch falling on the line, or snow load, it is a lot more reliable in terms of keeping your power on during the winter season. We've also been installing a lot of devices to sectionalize our system. These allow us to de-energize more quickly if we do have risk of a spark. It also helps us to identify where the fault might lie, so that we can tighten up that area, restore customers on the outside of that area, and then just work to repair and re-energize. You can go to the next slide. So these are the areas broken out here. If you kind of go clockwise, we have Mount Shasta, or counterclockwise, Mount Shasta and Weed, Happy Camp and Syed Valley, Fort Jones Etna, Klamath over on Highway 101, and then up into Crescent City and Smith River. On our website, you can see each one of these project areas. There's more information available on what we've done. You can go to the next slide. So kind of just going to roll through each of these fairly quickly. In Yreka, we've been working since 2020. One of the highlights on some of these slides, we just want to point out that the risk of wildfire in most of our communities across Siskiyou County and across our California service territory sits at a higher percentage risk of wildfire than most communities throughout the United States. So you can go ahead and go to the next slide, that's fine. Mount Shasta and Weed, we've done a lot of work. We've replaced 164 miles of line with covered conductor and replaced over 3,800 poles with non-wood poles. So we're using either steel or fiberglass poles to replace these wood poles. You can go to the next slide. Fort Jones and Etna, we still have a lot of activity going on over there. We're on track to replace 62 miles of line and over 1,800 poles. You can go to the next slide. And Happy Camp, we're almost done. We started there first, and we're almost complete in Happy Camp with a few projects pending, some final permitting. But again, 58 miles of line rebuilt, 1,100 poles. Can go to the next slide. And Crescent City, we are planning to start our line rebuild and our pole replacement in 2027. Those are pending some permits. But in the meantime, we have done a lot of, we've rebuilt all of our substations, we've installed new relays, we've added reclosers, we've replaced fuses with non-expulsion fuses so they don't spark when they blow. So very important and very, in terms of creating some fire resiliency and reliability, this was the low-hanging fruit that we could attack first in this area and in Klamath. You can go to the next slide. So if you want to go to the next slide, we'll just kind of go through accomplishments for the past 3 years. 2023, we replaced 95 miles of bare conductor. Over 4,000 non-expulsion fuses were added to the system. We did do some underground, you'll see there in the second bullet. And this always comes up, so I'll just address it now. I'm happy to answer questions later. But underground is very expensive. It's generally 2 to 2.5 times the cost of a covered conductor and non-wood poles. And so we choose very carefully where to do underground. We want it to make sense. We want it to be feasible and financially smart for both our customers and the company. You can go to the next slide. 2024, kind of a key here is just the amount of vegetation work we did. So you've probably seen our vegetation management folks out in the community, but over 7,000 trees were either pruned or removed. A lot of inspections for safety on our transmission and distribution facilities. You can go to the next slide. 2025, the key that we want to highlight here is that we stood up what we call the Wildfire Intelligence Center, or the WIC. So it is a 24/7 manned office that we have in Medford, and they are watching weather, fire cameras, 24/7 to look basically for ignitions and potential weather events that may result in additional wildfire risk throughout our service territory. We also implemented what we call fire and emergency response manager teams. So these are folks that are boots on the ground. They go out when there is a fire. They stand next to the incident command. They're mostly former CAL FIRE employees, so they have relationships with our emergency responders, and they have real life experience. And they're able to communicate directly to our Portland Control Center and dispatch real time to determine, you know, what the risk is to our infrastructure and when to safely de-energize the system for the safety of our customers, but also for the safety of our crews and the emergency responders. You'll see there at the bottom too, we also installed 39 new weather stations over the last 3 years. So we have a total of 122 throughout our California service territory. And those are very effective in helping us monitor weather for wildfire risk. You can go to the next slide. So yeah, that's it. I told you I'd be quick, leave time for questions. I hope I didn't go too fast through it, but the main points are back to that service territory, 11,000 square miles, it's a lot of ground to cover. We've come a long way, we have a long way to go, and it is a huge investment. And we want you to recognize the investment that we're making, but we also want to stress again that it's the safety of our customers and our communities that are behind all of these projects throughout our service territory. So that's all I have for today. Thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions.
I'm sure we have some.
A couple. One that comes out, and I'll relay this as a safety issue. You know, you went through in Mount Shasta where I live, and the lottery conducting, and when they make the connection to the primary, there's a cover. I've seen a lot of those drop off. They're laying at the base of the pole. So I'm just relaying that as a safety issue. Because you certainly don't want that hitting someone walking down the street, which we get a lot of people walking the boulevard in Mount Shasta. And I'm not saying one, because one I can live with, I can understand, but I'm seeing multiple place locations. So I think you need to look into that to a certain degree.
So I could probably answer that.
Yeah.
So, great point. A lot of what we're doing is kind of new age as far as how our connections
right.
are.
I get it.
And so what we have developed now is for pins to actually go in those covers. And so I actually have a project plan for 2027 to actually go and install those pins so that they can't fall down.
Great, I'm glad to hear this.
Prior, they didn't have that pin available. And so, yeah, those covers were coming off from time to time.
I bet you guys were ahead of the curve.
Especially like the weed area where it's so windy, they just fly off. And kind of research and development, trying to figure out what made the most sense to obviously be a cover to prevent, a possible ignition point. But those pins are really playing a big part.
Sounds like you have a plan and an answer to the question.
Yeah.
The secondary piece to it, you know, I can point to multiple locations in the Mount Shasta where you got three poles sitting there. You know, there's got to be a follow-up. I'm going to use the pole right in front across where I live. it was just cable TV. It's a bare pole sitting there. That's not an aesthetic pleasing, and I'm not worried about me looking at a pole. I don't, that doesn't bother me so much. I'm thinking about my tourist community in Mount Shasta, when you got multiple poles in there because the other utilities haven't transferred.
Right.
And I get that there's the whole PUC ownership and da-da-da-da, but you know, you're the instigator. You need to help push along the timing this to get this stuff done.
Yeah, so actually working with Caltrans, especially, and some other government entities, to try to kind of be that thumb on the other utilities to transfer. It is tough with these projects because they are expansive. You're talking 2 to 3 line miles per project and, say, 300-400 poles. So it takes maybe a few months to get those projects done.
Yeah.
And then there's a transition period where we give our joint users time to transfer. But I understand that there are areas that have gone way too long.
We're talking in excess of a year plus.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We'll rapidly get to 2. And I think one of the things that's exacerbated is we got Cal Orange come on, has got, you know, made an attachment, you got cable TV, you got AT&T, and, you know, all the things that are, you know, again, from an aesthetic.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
I would love it, you know, because I...
Well, that's why I wish they were undergrounded, so...
Definitely not the first to hear it. It's a challenge that our joint use department works with, you know, these other joint users on the pole to transfer. A lot of them are mom-and-pop type comm companies. And so,
for not them,
well, for them, it's a maintenance thing.
Yeah.
So they're losing money. Obviously, their connections work on the old pole. So it's a tough challenge. And trust me, it's something that we try to put at the forefront to try to mitigate.
Okay.
But it's an ongoing battle.
Okay. I'll defer to my fellow supervisors.
I'll go. Well, he beat me to it. He took the wind out of my sails on the transfer part. Even in my neighborhood, there's 3 poles stacked up there, and they're all topped. You know, we've got a new pole there, nice big steel pole, and then 2 other poles sitting there waiting to be transferred. And some are just vacant. You know, they just haven't been pulled yet.
Right.
I know the situation. You've got 2 ex utility employees sitting here that know the ropes, so
yeah,
we can't harp on it too much, but understood that that's just going to take time. Not a whole lot we can do about it, but it not only is it not pretty, but it also becomes a hazard too, because you've got cars and it's just traffic. It's environmental noise.
Right.
That needs to get handled, and I know it's not on your shoulders, it's on everybody else's, the other utilities. The other question I have is reliability. All this work that's being done, millions and billions of dollars of work, how's the reliability? Is that better than it used to be with all this work being done? What are the numbers there?
Yeah, I can, kind of in a general perspective, so I'm in Josephine County and we've deployed a lot of covered conductor in Josephine County. And so it's kind of a gold-plated system, right? And so in the areas like Cave Junction, the Illinois Valley, where we've deployed a lot of it, you know, it's still kind of too early statistically to kind of determine, but, you know, I'm hearing from folks from the city council there and so on and so forth that when the storms come through, the power stays on. And if you think about it, you know, the system, all the covered conductor, that just prevents, you know, the bird or the squirrel or the tree limb. So the more this that gets deployed, the less likely a fault is to occur. And so again, too early to tell from a statistical perspective, but hearing good things where we deployed this. We were in Happy Camp a while back and we were hearing good things from that community as well about reliability is improving. And so I think we're headed the right direction. That answers your question, Supervisor.
Yeah, it's there's a little bit of frustration with now we have power outages because of weather and impending weather, and they're extended outages. But then again, maybe we're not having power outages in the wintertime because these new lines are more reliable and there's more equipment being installed. So maybe there's some benefit. Maybe there's, you know, the folks out there are seeing some benefit to the fact that their bills are 2 and 3 times higher than they used to be. I mean, there's got to be some benefit to the costs that we're being incurred.
Yeah, it's a work in progress, and it should continually to get incrementally better as more and more of the cover conductors deployed.
Thank you.
I did ask the same question just in terms of data, and we do have a department actively working on it and tracking it. It's too soon. We don't have enough data yet and to, you know, produce a solid.
It'll be nice to see eventually.
But when we do, we will gladly share it.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully it'll be smoothed out, because I will tell you where I live in Mount Shasta, the perception is the power goes out far more frequently than it did before.
And it's always been.
But we're comparing apples and oranges, you know, so I maybe a year from now, whatever, there's, yeah. You know, how this, you know, the statistics do play out with that.
Yeah.
I just appreciate the work you guys are doing. I've had some interaction with your guys' vegetation clearing people. Especially like to give a kudos to those guys. That's hard and risky work. But they've been extremely pleasant to deal with, so kudos to them for sure.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
I had some questions.
Yeah.
A few years back, I don't know if you were here or not, but we were discussing roadblocks to vegetation management on power line right-of-ways on public lands. And it seemed that the Forest Service was kind of a stumbling block at the time. And I'm just curious if, because I know I worked with Congressman Lamalfa at the time, and put through some legislation that gave agencies some greater discretion and expedited approval for those things. I just, what's the current state of affairs? Because I'll be honest with you, that is the greatest risk to my communities.
Yeah, so, I mean, I work hand-in-hand with our vegetation management group, you know, as far as fire mitigation projects, because I have them come, basically go ahead of what a project is going to be going through that's slated to be replaced to make sure that we are having proper tree clearances for these new poles, because a lot of them are taller. I haven't had any concern with them being having their hands tied as far as, you know, from a government standpoint that's holding them back from getting the proper clearance and getting in there to those areas that really need the attention prior to us coming in to do construction. So whatever you did, I must have helped. I've been doing the PM work basically from the beginning in 2020 when we kind of the infancy of the fire mitigation group started with Pacific Power. So since then, it really hasn't been a big impact, at least from a fire mitigation standpoint.
Well, I guess the biggest thing was the clarification of when NEPA was required. Because under, going back years when I worked there, but they had flipped to a new interpretation of what triggered NEPA. And honestly, when you have a dedicated transmission line, a road or something, it's an administrative site and it's actually right. Exempt. But they were making you jump through all the hoops to get out there and do the clearing in a timely manner, and that's what the MOF was about to clarify. So I'm glad to hear it's working. The other question I have is based on the fire risk piece and the slide that you showed about high fire areas. What goes into your, what parameters go into your assessment of your risk areas?
In terms of the models that we're using?
Yeah.
It's very similar to what the state's using. It's how much, you know, the cover forest vegetation.
Okay.
And then I believe, whether we're using weather and...
So there's quite a few parameters. I mean, we go by, you know, basically the U.S. Forest Service's their graph of like high density tree vegetation, okay. Low relative humidity areas,
right.
And then we kind of have our own sense of like how we developed our own program. A lot of that's dependent on these weather stations. So they're like what I call like a microclimate is what it's trying to identify, because different areas, even a couple square miles apart, can have completely different disadvantages to a fire or advantages. So I think that's kind of the pivotal part of our program. And obviously, we didn't just invent this. You know, we're basically taking best practices from a lot of other utilities that are going through these same processes, Southern Cal Edison, Pacific Gas and Electric and some even back east, and taking kind of what they have done with their program, and we've developed our
own. I fly Cal Fire vehemently over their fire maps. Their models stink. I guess one of the fallacies I see in that, and I hope yours isn't the same, is if a fire does move through, cleans up the fuel, or if there are fuels projects, the risk ought to reflect that. I don't know if yours does or not, but Cal Fire's does not. So you're always locked into peril, no matter even if you pave your property, which makes absolutely no sense in the fire behavior realm.
Yeah, and I live up in Grants Pass along with Alan, so Oregon Department of Forestry did something very similar and put out, you know, a statistic of your house lived is here in this geographical area, so maybe your homeowner's insurance might cancel you. And so, you know, I went through that. I had to even, you know, justify, you know, the perimeter of trees that I took around my house to make a buffer, you know. So Cal Fire does the same thing. Our aspects of how we look at fuels and things like that are a little bit different than just the standardized Cal Fire or U.S. Forest Service look at it. I think we take a lot more of the community aspects and what we know because we work and live here in these areas and into account. And like I said, having these microclimate weather stations is 24/7, 365 data, you know, that we take. And we've been doing that for, like I said, 5 years now. So that data has really reflected how we are approaching our fire mitigation projects and where we really try to address the next projects, where we want to hit, you know, all based on that kind of evolving system.
I'm glad to hear that because, like in my district, Cal Fire doesn't do a risk assessment on their map outside of their jurisdiction. So Happy Camp is risk-free because it's not covered by them, which makes absolutely no sense at all. So anyway, I'm glad to hear yours is a little more interactive than that. There's, I've said it before, so it's no secret, I said there seems to be more of a funding mechanism than anything else. So anyway, I'm glad to hear. Glad to see the work. I appreciate the work that I see in Scott Valley. You know, you've been under threat for a long time. The power lines are one big piece of that. So, thank you very much. And if we have no other questions, okay.
Thank All right, you. Thank you. You. Thank you for your time.
All right. I'll move to 7A, Office of Emergency Services.
Good morning, Board of Supervisors. Brian Shinoni, Director of Emergency Services, for you. It's just a continuation of the local emergency for pesticides. We are in the process of rewriting. It's taking a lot longer than I thought. And we're requesting another extension before we get the next one out.
You getting any help from public health?
There is a meeting that we were supposed to have, but I'm not the director of public health, so I don't
know. Well, I'm just wondering if they agree to that because we've asked that.
Yes, so, and that should be, of course, I believe there's an email in our box. Our push is forward. Our pesticide push is we've gotten a lot of help from the state. Our contact with the state has moved now to the federal level, so it's been able to help us even more. And we've got a lot of good things on the horizon when it comes to the emergency services side of it, as well as the next item, which is the sheriff's. Again, we're waiting for the public health.
Okay. Move to extend.
Second.
Here, Wendy. Okay, Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yep.
Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
And Supervisor Howell?
Aye.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Thank you. Item 8A.
It's just one of those brought back.
Everybody's on vacation this week, huh?
Good morning, Board of Supervisors. We're going to show you Director of Emergency Services. This is for the cannabis cultivation. Sheriff is at Sacramento today. No changes on that until we are updated and we're going to set all of them together.
Okay.
Move to extend.
Extend. Thank you. And the second?
I second.
Thank you. All right. Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yep.
Supervisor Ogren?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
And Supervisor Hill?
Aye.
Thank you.
All right. Recess the Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors and convene as the Flood Control and Water Conservation District. This time is for public comment. Seeing none in house.
Showing none online.
None online. Consent agenda. I'm going to pull two for discussion. Wishes the board on the rest.
Good to approve.
Second.
All right. Director Valenzuela?
Okay.
Director Ogren?
Aye.
Director Harris?
Aye.
And Director Hill?
Aye. Anybody here from, yes, Adam's here.
Wouldn't miss it. Adam Filippone, Director of General Services.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pretty simple question. I just want to draw some attention to the fact that the Lake Siskiyou area is a major revenue generator for South County. And as such, I'd like to know if we have a comprehensive fuels management and public protection plan put in place by our Forest Service that manages that vegetation.
I believe we do, and I can bring that to you.
Okay, that's the only question I had.
Okay.
If we don't, please do.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you for bringing that up. I mean, Adam, we have conversations about this all the time, right, about how important South County, particularly the campground, I don't think. Maybe we can have a full breadth of where we are, we RFP that we're going to go out for and all that entail, because I think that's
That would be good, because one fire that ruins the view is going to ruin the record.
I told you know what, we have a project there and people pitch to fit, and you know, I'm at the point where, you know, and I tell people all the time, if we lose infrastructure, a fire, it's not coming back in my lifetime.
No.
You know, so whatever we're doing, you know, pitch your fit, but we've got to do something.
Yeah. So maybe we can bring that back and give us a presentation on what's going on there. Mm-hmm.
Including lake levels.
I'm actually pretty surprised with how bad of a winter how good the lake looks right now.
Yeah, me too.
So I was out there yesterday and I was pleasantly surprised.
I'm grateful for you being on top of it. Thank you.
All right. Move to approve.
Second.
Director Valenzuela?
Yes.
Director Ogren?
Aye.
Director Harris?
Aye.
And Director Hill?
Aye.
All right, we'll recess adjourn the Siskiyou Flood Control and Water Conservation District and reconvene as the Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors. And I'm going to go, you need a break before we go to the hearings? Wendy?
What's that?
You need a break before I go to the hearing or?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Item 10, public hearing.
Hey.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Favorite topic?
Yes. Good morning, Board of Supervisors. Haley Lane, Community Development Director. So we have not chatted about Wellington Act, I think, since about March. And so during that discussion, you know, we had discussed certain topics about in an attempt to strengthen the program and topics surrounding issues such as breach of contract, water usage, compliance with ag operations in terms of hobby farming and recreational farming, and in general having a better set of objective standards that we could better implement the program. And so the purpose of this presentation and discussion today is just to preview with you all the working draft of the Williamson Act guidelines updates that staff has been working on. We have also been working with outside partners such as UC Cooperative Extension, Farm Bureau. They are currently reviewing the guidelines. A lot of folks are busy right now, so we also want to allow for time for people to review the changes, provide any meaningful comment, and you know, allowing time for those discussions. In the next couple slides, there are some changes I wanted to discuss, and so for some program clarifications and administrative updates, we have a few. And so in the next few slides, I'm going to focus more on the conservation program issues, breach of contract issues, things like that. But for the purpose of this slide, a few different or a few updates include: one, defining primary agricultural use. We had not done that before. It really wasn't clear in our guidelines that the producers involved in the Williamson Act are to be producing agriculture, and that is the primary use. Obviously, we allow for diversification of uses and compatible uses, but it really hadn't been clear in our guidelines that the principal intent of Williamson Act is that you are primarily conducting an agriculture business. So we made that clear in the guidelines. Administrator authority for additional verification. We clarified that the administrator may require additional verification, particularly through the Ag Commissioner. So the Planning Division reviews the Williamson Act program, right? We are not ag producers, we don't work in that space. And so in an event to have verification from the Ag Commissioner office, it may help issues where there are those contracts that are brought forward to you where maybe compliance is in the gray. And so in an effort to not have that happen and not have the board have to hear those types of contracts, we thought that potentially agricultural commissioner verification may be helpful. Again, we haven't received formal buy-in from that office yet, so again, this is why we're not presenting this as a final document today.
Excuse me, Haley.
Yes?
I need to ask a protocol question. This is under public hearings, but we're not ready for a public hearing.
Yes,
yet.
Yes. So technically it's an open, she's doing a staff report, and then we'll have to go through the other
steps.
The protocol.
After this.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, no problem. So again, conservation activities, government code 51238. We recognize in the rules that conservation activities may be compatible uses under state law, while making clear that compatibility depends on the actual activity and its effect on contracted agricultural use. Also, we further defined objective standards related to commercial agriculture and grazing. Next slides. So proposed changes, commercial viability. So in our current rules, we identify that qualifying agricultural uses, acreage thresholds, and income verification requirements. We do not establish a standard on evaluating whether agricultural operation is commercially viable. And so with the proposed rules that we have establishing commercial viability standard requiring ag operations to be conducted primarily for commercial production of agricultural commodities and demonstrate ongoing production, management, and income sufficient to support a reasonable continuation of an operation. So the purpose of this is to establish a clearer standard for distinguishing bona fide commercial agricultural operations from agricultural activity that is otherwise incidental token or maintained solely to retain Williamson Act benefits. Next slide. Proposed changes, conservation uses. So in our current rules, conservation programs may be allowed when they do not change or stop the agricultural use. Programs that temporarily or permanently change agricultural use require review and approval. And so with the proposed rules, we clarify that a conservation program that reduces agricultural production below commercially viable levels or causes conservation to become the primary use of the property constitutes a change in use. And we do have a change in use section, which I'll discuss in the next slide. And so the purpose of that is to allow compatible conservation uses because we have to under state law. But we make it clear that the conservation activities cannot take away from the agricultural use that has historically operated on a certain property. Next slide. And so conservation uses, how the proposed rules are more restrictive. So conservation can no longer be used to substitute for commercial agriculture. Conservation programs that change the agricultural use of the property are subject to county review. The actual use controls the property, not a conservation easement or some incidental conservation use that is occurring on property. And the breach provisions now specifically capture conservation-related conversion of certain properties, which I'll discuss in the next slides. Proposed changes, breach of contract. So we do not have breach of contract, or we currently do not have breach of contract language in our current guidelines. This is something that is very, very common in most, if not all, other Wellington Act guidelines that I've reviewed throughout the state. And so with the proposed rules, we established a consolidated material breach standard identifying specific circumstances that may constitute material breach, including conversion to unapproved non-agricultural use, cessation of commercial agriculture, establishment of an incompatible use, misrepresentation, failure to meet commercial use thresholds, failure to fix a violation, or when commercial agriculture is no longer the primary use of the property. So the purpose of this is to provide clear and more consistent standards for identifying and addressing material breaches while preserving an opportunity to cure and recognize the temporary reductions that may be caused by issues outside of a landowner's control, like pollution, for example. Next slide. So proposed changes, change in use. So the current rules address agriculture and compatible uses, but do not provide a consolidated standard for determining when a significant change in the functional agricultural use of the contracted land requires county review. So the proposed rules establish a clearer standard for evaluating a change in use, including when a change causes the existing agricultural use to become incidental or subordinate to another use. Changes that result in unapproved non-agriculture or incompatible use or cause commercial agriculture to cease or be reduced outside of the primary use of the property may require county review and may constitute a material breach. And so the purpose of this provides a clearer basis for distinguishing ordinary changes in agriculture operations from changes that effectively convert the contracted property to another use while for allowing for property owners to also diversify their property when needed. And so compliance review process, this is a simplified matrix of what the proposed process would be, but one, we would determine the agricultural use for a given contract. If a question arises, potentially there may be information from the Ag Department, and that is the same with step two, determine commercial viability. If a question arises, having the Ag Department verify that. And so our thoughts too is this is also, I know for like the soil standards, right? I know some property owners do have issues with that. If there is still a commercially viable operation, this may be a pathway for folks to get verification, for example, from the Ag Commissioner, so they're still able to stay in the program. So that's an example of how that would play out. Three, determine compatibility. We would, if a question arises, we would evaluate whether the proposed use is compatible with agricultural use and does not displace or impair agriculture. Four, evaluate any changes of use or a breach of contract. If a question arises, staff would determine whether an agricultural use has become incidental or subordinate. And then five, enforcement. There is now a process for if there's any specific issues involved in a certain property in order to determine non-compliance with the Wellington Act program. Next slide. So I would like to just open it up after the public hearing protocol for further edits and suggestions. I would just like to note that this was staff's attempt at still being able to create flexibility with our program with the ever-changing landscape that this program has turned into, but also having objective standards that the board, staff, and members of the public can rely on. I would say, staff also worked with county council on, revisions and additions related to legalese of material breach and tried to create, again, flexible but yet objective standards. I will say, I know there's been maybe questions in the past or discussions regarding material breach or change of use of, why not put something like any change is a change of use, therefore material breach. we could do that. That is something I have seen in other county guidelines. I would say that is a more strict approach, but you know, thinking ahead and maybe for a purpose of discussion today, it would affect all landowners that would have any change in use, whether minor or significant. But again, that's my presentation. Those are my general comments, and happy to answer any questions or clarify anything further.
In a minute.
Yep.
All right.
So we've technically opened the hearing.
We opened the hearing and reading of the order. You want me to do that? Or you do that?
Yeah, and then this would be her staff report.
Correct. I'm upside down today.
I'm sorry. It's a little different than other public hearings.
Yeah, it's going to get really different here in a minute. Presentation of correspondence. Is there any correspondence?
Nothing at the clerk's level.
Any reports, arguments, or evidence by staff or other departments? Opponents' arguments. Seeing none in house. Opponents' arguments. Seeing none.
Sharing none online.
And then public comments.
Sharing none online.
I think we'd have some, but yeah. No rebuttals. I'm not going to close the hearing, and I'm going to bring it back to the board for discussion.
Well, I'll just say a couple of comments for something that is so important to ag. I can only assume we're on the right path, that we're doing okay, because typically when there's a, you know, the grapevine will get some, hey, they're going to eliminate the Williams Act, this place would be filled, technically.
Yeah.
But the fact that there's no one here, I feel like we're making correct steps, if you will. I've long been, I've come around, I've long thought we're giving too much of a free hand to people that are not compliant, so I'm glad we're making progress. I'm surprised that it's taken us this long to go through, and we still have more to go, because it's a significant hit to the general fund, to this county. And, you know, I've heard for all the years I've been on this, as a supervisor, how important ag is, and it is, and the demise of, which hopefully never happens. So I've come to grips with allowing Williams to act in what I would call big ags, people that are making a living off that. I'm glad you bring up hobby farming. I would love to have a hobby farm, and I would love to be in a Williams act, but I didn't ever anticipate that happening. So thank you for all the work that you're putting into this, and thank you for this went before the Planning Commission, did it not?
Mm-mm.
Not yet?
No.
Hopefully they'll see the same thing. Thank you. That's it.
So far, it's looking good to me. You know, maintaining flexibility while having clear standards, and maybe having another level of administrative overlook on it, you know, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. So far, everything looks good.
I still have a little bit of worry that conservation land is going to take over.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to look at that a little bit more, just to make sure that we're not giving our land away, or turning it over where it shouldn't be turned over, to let ag go and not having it preserved in the right way, and make sure that balance is still toward ag,
mm-hmm,
and useful property management,
mm-hmm,
and not just tying up our land so it cannot be used and our water rights are given away. The state has infused itself, and we can't afford to let that happen anymore. And if we can reverse it somehow, that would be even better. But we need to be super careful about that.
Mm-hmm.
So our wording has to be very specific about that conservation easement part and any land trusts. So we need to be really careful about that. That's my biggest,
mm-hmm,
observation.
Okay. You ready?
Here we go.
Yeah, as we discussed, I don't think we're ready to schedule the actual hearing.
Mm-hmm.
of this, because we're still kind of in a deliberative phase.
Yep.
Number one, to me, he places a lot of trust on the Ag Commissioner. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest with you, I've asked for a lot of those figures in the past from the Ag Commissioner, and I don't get them. Okay. Our Ag Commissioner doesn't even know how many acres were fallowed due to curtailments. That scares me. So placing all that trust there, I'm not real comfortable with. I don't know how we massage that or how we strengthen that piece, but it needs to be strengthened.
Okay.
Along those lines, just in general concept, if you have a Williamson Act contract, I expect you to manage that land to its maximum potential. But I don't see that in this. Because if you're not, you're getting subsidized at the county's expense and not maximizing the profits that keep us productive. There's a lot of great work in here, but I still think it's very weak on the water piece and water management. From my perspective, my opinion, the state uses public funds to buy a ranch to dewater it. That's an instant termination. Mm-hmm. And the reason being is I don't want to go 10 years trying to recoup the money back from an NGO that's just sold the water rights to the state, but does us no good from a tax standpoint. Mm-hmm. Now, let's see, that's pretty strong in there. And then habitat restoration, if we're talking about, you know, fencing some cows out of a creek, that's one thing. But we're talking about turning half of a ranch into Beaver Valley salmon nirvana. That's not a qualifying activity.
Right.
Anyway, I really think one of the biggest issues that I wrestle with the Williamson Act is the lack of immediacy to deal with changes that are not meeting the four corners of what's in that contract. Mm-hmm. And this 10-year delay thing just penalizes the county. So that termination piece has to be stronger for me.
Okay.
And Supervisor Kopsep is back just in time. You think Williamson Act comes?
Williamson Act. I know.
You're last.
Okay. I know we met and talked about this, and you provided some, you know, direction to this.
Yep.
You know, I agree with Supervisor Haupt. At the time that we talked, there wasn't the number of properties that are starting to come under state purchase, you know, in some form. And so whatever we can do to strengthen that element, it's just with a 10 to 12% tax base and mm-hmm. that beginning to be eroded, it's going to be problematic.
Yes. If I may, with the discussion about a state agency purchasing a piece of property, I do know there is a clear government code section that prohibits that. I'll discuss it further with county council, but it is something already embedded in state code, but perhaps if we build upon that and put it in our local document, I'll get with council on how to best handle that.
I was going to chase that a little more too.
Okay.
One of the things that I'm that got triggered in my mind as we were talking about this, there's also a zoning code that has to be met to meet the Williamson Act. I can't remember what it's something farming.
Yeah, it's the farmland. Is it the farmland security
something.
Zone? But it is
another
related state code under.
Right, and I'm just wondering if council's ever looked at that being a way to block these state sales.
Okay.
Well, we're done.
Because the state is unilaterally changing the land use without going through the planning commission.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I know in the past, I want to say it was 3 years ago or so, we our office received those notices like way after the fact. So
right.
I believe you are aware of that.
Yep.
If I could add something else, our initial discussion regarding, you know, verification so folks can have another pathway for compliance, you know, we initially thought about having other folks such as maybe Ag Cooperative Extension or a professional within the ag space, like a soil scientist or other related functions could provide the verification. You know, when we spoke to a couple people, their thought was, well, we would likely contact the ag department for formal records anyways. So that was our thought of potentially streamlining it, but do you have any additional thoughts on having
that piece is more problematic in my district when it comes down to looking at the land classification for the Scott Bell area plan.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you first meet that test and then you meet the Williamson Act test.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yes.
From the perspective of the soil layers, given the water restrictions that we have, a lot of the lands in Scott Valley that were classified as Ag 1 are not commercially viable as Ag 1 because of the coarse rock content and the water required to put on that land to grow a crop.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how this all wraps around one another, but it's become a real issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Through the chair. So I know that the board has a no net loss. I think it's just a resolution, not a ordinance, with regard to public land purchase of private property.
Mm-hmm.
We have trade-offs, but I don't know where this comes into play with that either, but we might take a look at that.
Absolutely.
I know it was directed at the federal side, but I'm not sure state lands came into that or not.
Okay, I'll look into that with council.
Okay.
And I don't, you know, one other thing, and I, it's not really Williamson Ag piece, but part of the issues we're dealing with, when you're not in Williamson Ag and you're not producing, you're not irrigating, you're producing fuels that are putting my communities at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's a something to consider with Williamson Act, or whether it's a zoning issue or where that is, that's probably another discussion to have with council, because it's particularly a problem in Scott Valley. We have Ag 2 laced through rural residential.
Yes.
And we've seen that with the fire fuels modeling we've done and how it extremely exacerbates fire behavior when you're not irrigating those Ag 2 lands or operating them commercially as ag land.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to tie onto that, what effects does that have on Sigma or GSPs,
mm-hmm.
you know, in yeah. correlation with Williamson?
Sure.
Got enough?
I think so. Okay.
The request is to continue the hearing to September 15, but Sherry, isn't that our adopted budget?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hearing that day as well.
Yeah,
so.
I'd like to continue to a hearing uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
We being a public hearing, I believe we do have to have a date certain to continue.
Can we close it and then?
It's well, if you close it, you'd have to open, redo, and do another one.
Okay.
Is the budget really going to take that long? Yeah, I would schedule for the September. I can't see the budget taking.
The only reason I'm saying is I don't know if we're going to be done with the gyrations we got to go through to be able to get it published and be able to have it on the 15th.
I still think it comes back for because it's an opportune time for more. Get the public involved, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay.
Good.
Because we can always extend it again.
So you can bring back a revised.
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay.
So
I just didn't want to hamstring you.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Continue to September 15.
Yeah.
Is okay. Thank you.
With a revised.
What's that?
With a revised policy.
With what? Yeah, she'll be. You'll bring back
revised
more.
Revised document. Yep.
And it, It's not like a second reading, but it'll be the continued public hearing in Questa, so there should be a space for additional documents. Mm-hmm. These that are already there, and then bring in some more if you have something to come back in.
Yep, we'll attach a revised. And
did you have a PowerPoint for me on that one? Did you have a PowerPoint for me? Mm-hmm. Oh, awesome, thank you. And the next one is also a public hearing, so we'll need to do the protocol. I think we're good.
That's the end of this one. Okay.
Yeah.
Next, let me open a public hearing on Code Enforcement Authority regarding parked and abandoned vehicles on public roads and county rights of ways. Staff report.
Yes, hello, Haley Lane, Community Development Director. So we have a presentation before you all today to discuss code enforcement authority, limitations, enforcement processes. We've had a lot of questions from members of the public recently in the last few months regarding, what is the legal authority if someone abandons a vehicle on my private property. And so since we've had a lot of discussions with board members of the public, we thought this would be an ample time to, do a brief presentation on the process, just so everyone can be made aware and so it's in the record. Next slide. So today we will be discussing code enforcement authority, clarifying what the county can and cannot do, explaining our enforcement tools, reviewing common enforcement scenarios, and discuss legal limitations. Next slide. So where does our authority come from? Our authority comes from county code, which includes citation procedures, building regulations, planning and zoning law, and nuisance abatement. Our authority also comes from state law, government code, health and safety code, code of civil procedures, and many others. Next slide. So we are a complaint-driven division. So we only have three code enforcement officers on staff to cover our wide range of counties. So we are primarily complaint-driven. And so typically what happens is we receive a complaint. We investigate the complaint. We try to achieve voluntary compliance with members of the public regarding a certain violation or code case. If that does not happen, then we go to the next step, which is administrative action, then potential civil remedies, and then potentially abatement when authorized in the processes. The Board of Supervisors will authorize that abatement action. We have a number of available enforcement tools in our toolkit, including notice of violation, administrative citations, civil action, and nuisance abatement. Next slide. That was a double slide. And so, abandoned vehicles. So typically what happens is the code enforcement team investigates potential county code violations. They will open a code enforcement case when warranted. They will attempt to seek voluntary compliance first, issue notices and citations when violations do remain, and they may pursue formal nuisance abatement through the legal process when authorized. And so for property owner options, they can either remove the vehicle themselves, they can arrange for removal through a licensed tow company and correct the violation before any further enforcement action. Next slide. And so abandoned vehicles, so when they are on private property, the property owner remains responsible. So in the unfortunate case when someone abandons a vehicle on their property, they are still the ones liable and unfortunately are the ones that are required to remove that vehicle. If it's on county property, the county right-of-way, we have the authority to remove abandoned vehicles. If it is on state highway, that would be CHP and Caltrans jurisdiction. Next slide. What code enforcement cannot do. We cannot enter a private property without authority. We cannot ignore due process. We cannot remove vehicles without legal basis. And we cannot compel action outside of county code or state law. So the key takeaways, just to state, authority is established by county code and state law. Voluntary compliance is preferred whenever practical. Due process protects property owners. Some situations require lengthy legal processes before actions can occur, and staff only acts within the authority provided by law. Next slide. Questions?
Had to get a picture of my house.
This is the site in Happy Camp, right, I think.
I was gonna say, that's in my district.
Yeah, I was gonna say. And maybe this didn't make it to this PowerPoint, but I did have some slides as well. I have Andrea Fox, our code enforcement supervisor here, James Phelps, planning director, and we were gonna preview really quickly a program that they developed called the Dumpster Voucher Program. This has been approved by County Council, and so the intent of the program is to help our code enforcement cases that need help when they have enormous amounts of trash, things of the like, and aren't able to financially take care of the issue themselves. And so we are creating a process where folks can, essentially apply it to the county to have an authorized dumpster put on their property, near their property, to help facilitate cleanup in order to achieve voluntary compliance. And so this program is geared towards, folks that, maybe they might be older, not might be able to physically, remove trash and things themselves, disabilities, low income, so they're not able to clean up, but they want to achieve voluntary compliance. So sort of a, community benefit that we tried to think of to where we're trying to help out these types of cases, and they are very, very common in this county. So I just wanted to make you all aware that that's a new program we're rolling out, and so hopefully it helps. So that was just a sidebar I wanted to add.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Do we have any correspondence?
None at the clerk's level.
Any reports or arguments or evidence by other county departments or public agencies? Any proponents' arguments?
Showing none online.
Opponents' arguments?
Showing none online.
Any public comment?
Showing none online.
Seeing none in house either. I'm not closing this hearing, I guess.
Yeah, there's no action, so you could close it.
I can close it. Okay, I'll close the hearing and bring it back to the court. My main question is what does a homeowner do? Because it's a question I get all the time. Mm-hmm. Someone else dumps their vehicle on my property, and I attempt to remove it. Isn't that theft of someone's property because it may be registered as a vehicle or something? I mean, when does an entity like Highway Patrol or somebody get involved in the disposal of a vehicle that's abandoned on your land?
Yes. So we had this discussion maybe a year or so ago about the Abandoned Vehicle Authority Program. The acronym is something similar to that. But anyways, it is a program that's typically passed by the voters. A JPA is established to essentially handle this issue. I believe there is a $1 surcharge on folks and their DMV registrations to supplement the program. That is the legal process for when CHP becomes involved, normally outside of the purview of, an abandoned vehicle is left on the state highway jurisdiction. And we do not have that.
Okay, but CHP does. And I'm just reflecting on the vehicle in Hawkinsville that was 19 inches off the county right away.
Yes.
And it seems like everybody was calling somebody else's mm-hmm. problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, James, do you have anything to add?
So the issue, if the county gets involved on a piece of property, is the county has to obey all these due process requirements. They have to give notice to the James Phelps, Siskiyou County. When a vehicle is abandoned on private property and the county gets involved, the county is restricted by county ordinance and state law, as opposed to a private property owner. Someone's abandoned a car on my property, I can just have it removed. It's been abandoned. It's littering or trespass on my property. So that property owner has more leeway to have that vehicle removed as opposed to the county taking action. The county would have to locate the last registered owner of that vehicle, has to give that person opportunity hearing. The costs to implement something like that is just, it's not feasible. It would be more practical for the county to implement a system or a program where we assisted private property owners to remove vehicles off their property with their permission. That could cut all the red tape, and I think the cost of a program like that would be minimal compared to trying to enforce involuntary compliance.
And my other question is, given the screenshot that we have in front of us here, this isn't the only one in the county. We struggle with it. I think we've been able to, in my tenure on the board, I think we've maybe worked through maybe one or two of these. Mm-hmm. What do we need to do in our code or our policies to fix these things quicker?
Mm-hmm. I would really promote or recommend that the board implement a program, like I said, using county employees and resources, even if we have to get an outside vendor to come into these places. Code enforcement has in the past done crushing programs, that sort of thing, but it's a one-off type of thing where we have to get everybody together and see if there's enough vehicles, as opposed to knowing a location like this exists, we could have a code enforcement case and then ensure voluntary compliance by bringing in our own capabilities and just removing those vehicles. Right now, we're relying on, well, we'll have a hearing, we'll take them to court, blah, 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 as opposed to just get boots on the ground. Because that has value. It looks like junk, but when you crush it, it does have value. Mm-hmm. So I think a program like that, countywide, would cover a lot of the, and it would dovetail perfectly into what general services are already doing with the transfer station, that sort of thing. And it would amplify the capacity of the county.
I'd also encourage the county to seek some grants for this kind of work too, because I know mm-hmm. 15 years ago I partnered when I was a ranger with the county in Salmon River. We removed over 300 vehicles out of Salmon River, and it broke even, because of the salvage value.
And that's what we were thinking as well. And I know code enforcement is currently pursuing grants of that nature through Cal EPA. So we're on it. It's just, but yeah, if there was direction from the board to pursue some sort of program like that, working with general services, I think it makes sense to get into the recycling business. We have so much of that here in the county. Yeah. It would break even or make money for general services.
Okay. Anybody else?
Mm-hmm. How big of a dumpster can you get on a street corner for people to put abandoned cars in?
Right. That would be the
just
easy
a question.
Fix. Yeah.
You've already got the program in place.
Could be a tourist attraction.
So the dumpster program really is focused on, the elderly, someone that mm-hmm. might have a lot of property. People are just dumping stuff on her property or mm-hmm. street property. So it's something that we see it's going to be more beneficial to the county to just get this stuff cleaned up, as opposed to saying, I know you're 87 years old, but you're liable. It's not feasible, mm-hmm. As opposed to us going out there and just saying, okay, here's the dumpster. Do what you can, throw it in there, get your neighbors to help. We found that works well.
Mm-hmm. I think we're good.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Council, do we have a closed item or no?
No closed item, so we would need a motion to remove the closed session from the agenda.
All right.
So moved.
Second.
And I'm sorry, what was the motion again?
To remove closed session from the agenda.
Remove it from the agenda. Thank you. All righty, Supervisor Valenzuela.
Oh, for sure.
Supervisor Ogren.
Aye.
Supervisor Thompson.
So what are we doing, not having a closed session? Is that what I mean? No.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
And Supervisor Howell?
Aye. I think we covered it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's why I guess I'm voting no. So.
Okay. We'll talk.
Okay.
I'll talk. I'll speak to Supervisor Cox about it.
Okay, thank you.
And any board and staff reports?
I don't know, it's a short week.
It was a short week.
Anybody have any? No, I don't either. Ed, do you have anything?
Oh, I got all kinds, but I'm going to save it for another day. Hey, we're getting out early, so.
Yeah, I sense your enthusiasm. Nancy?
None.
All right then, we are adjourned.